Right? Let's take the mitzvah of Yibum. What's the mitzvah of Yibum? The mitzvah of Yibum says that if a person dies, still practice today, it's a mitzvah. If a person dies without children, there is a mitzvah on his brother to marry his widow to try to perpetuate the line. And today we don't practice Yibum, but the Torah says if the brother does not want to marry his sister-in-law, or if she doesn't want to marry him, there's a ceremony which we do practice today where called chalitza. Chalitza means she takes off a shoe. It's a special boot, like a Viking boot. In fact, right, well, yeah, but she takes off his boots and she spits. Now, the Torah says she spits in his face, but the rabbinic interpretation is she spits in front of him, not in his face. And she says to him, "So shall be done to the man who does not want to rebuild his brother's home." Now, I've always had a problem with that in the sense that I understand that ceremony if he doesn't want to marry her. But let's say he says he wants to marry her and she doesn't want to marry him. She does the same thing. It's a little hard to understand. What is she spitting at if he's the one that says, "I'm ready to go ahead"?
Just tell me the Rova that she'll want to marry him.
Yeah. That's the assumption, but the problem is that but we still go through, right.
The first son, they say, will be a gilgal of the husband.
That's correct.
So, how would she not, if she loved the husband, she'd want to...
Right. But nevertheless, it does say, the Gemara says, for example, if the man is repulsive or whatever it is, she has the right to say, I don't want to be with him. But she does the same ceremony. Say again?
The man has the right to
of a get, that's a get, but when you're dealing with a yavama, the issue is chalitza. There's no gets in this case. There's only a get if he marries her and then wants to divorce her, but until he marries her, there's only chalitza. Okay, now here's the question. Man dies, leaves over no children, except an offspring that was obtained through a human cloning process. So here's the thing. If his clone is his child, because it was taken from his DNA, his wife does not need chalitza, and she would be allowed to marry anybody she wants. But here is what is wild. If his clone is his brother, so there are no children, but not only are there no children, but she has to have yibum or chalitza, and you know who would be the one. If there's no other brother, let's assume there's no other brother, the clone is the only one. The clone would actually be the one. First of all, that would mean she'd have to wait 13 years till he's bar mitzvah. That's another big problem. But she'd be in trouble. She'd have to wait 13 years. And then the very guy that would marry her because of Yibum would be the baby that emerged from her womb. Because that halachically is considered not her son. Halachically it's considered her husband's brother. Okay, so, well, it's wild. Okay, well, it's a difficult. Now, again, I have no answer to this question at all. I'm just throwing out to people to recognize the halachic complexities that the gedolim are going to have to deal with. Now, again, this is all theoretical. I'm not saying there'll be a practical question like this, but from a theoretical standpoint, this is something to consider. Yeah.
How can it work out that he's a brother?
Because essentially a clone is my identical twin.
Right.
And therefore, he halakhically is my brother, which means my parents, the kids, what looks like the kid's grandparents, might actually be his parents.
So then how does it work out that he can be the son?
Well, I'm not saying he's both. I'm saying that it is uncertain if halakha would classify him as son or brother, and that would have different consequences. Yeah, I'm not saying he's both. I'm saying he's one or... Or the other.
Why would she have to wait for chalitza?
Well, because if there is a brother, if there is a brother, then she's not allowed to marry anyone else until there's chalitza. There's no other son. Her husband died.
And that kid
was born before him. Yeah. So if he's a brother. Now again, by the way, this is a hardship in general. In other words, forget about cloning for a second, just to be sure you understand the halacha. I mean, this is a real hardship. If a man dies, and there's no son, and the only brother he left, a regular brother, not a clone, the only brother he left is a little baby, it in reality is a hardship. She is stuck for until that kid is bar mitzvah, because yibam or chalitza cannot be done until the child is bar mitzvah. So there are real hardships. I'm just saying that cloning would introduce another level of complexity to that. Yeah. Well, you know, once again, it's hard to do this. You know, when we have a Sanhedrin, which Mashiach will come, etc., we might be able to just make new categories. But in terms of the ability of Poskim today, Poskim have to take the categories and the structures based on the Gemara, the Rishonim, the Shulchan Aruch, and every new phenomenon needs to be fit into that. In fact, there's a very interesting discussion that the Chazon Ish has. Is there such a thing, and I think you're hitting on that, as a lacuna in halacha? The word lacuna is a fancy word, but it just means an omission. Are there any cases that there's no halacha for? In other words, is there any cases in which Torah just doesn't address it? The Chazon Ish strenuously argued that there was no such thing, that there is in Torah a specific... Now, we may have disagreements which rule to apply. We may have uncertainties which rule to apply because of our lack of understanding. But the Chazon Ish categorically denied for which there is no halachic rule. On the other hand, as great a posek as the Shach, who lived hundreds of years before the Chazon Ish, did suggest in another context that there are some things for which halacha does not provide. He actually says some things we don't have a halacha for. But the Chazon Ish said there was no such thing, that there was always going to be a halacha, and in the absence of a Sanhedrin, we got to fit things into existing categories. But it's an interesting question. Can there be things for which there's no halacha? Now, again, Rabbi Bleich also echoes the Chazon Ish, where the Rabbi Bleich says, Rabbi Bleich, he's a rabbi in New York, great rabbi in New York, he says that even when you don't know the halacha, you have a halacha. The halacha is... that if it's a suffek, if it's a doubtful issue about a Torah prohibition, you got to be strict. If it's a doubtful issue about a rabbinic prohibition, you got to be lenient. In other words, there is a rule even when you're ignorant. In other words, halacha always has a particular rule. Now, again, I understand that these are far-fetched possibilities, but just to show you that these are not simple things. Now, let me give you another example of this problem. Let's take a female clone, and consider this. Now, this will parallel our surrogate mothership issue, but it'll give you another context. Let's take a female clone. In other words, now in a female clone, you can have up to four different candidates for mother. It's even more complicated than surrogate motherhood. Imagine this situation. Again, woman takes DNA from her fingernail. So we'll call woman number one DNA contributor. It is inserted in the egg of woman number two. So call her egg donor. It is carried in the uterus of woman number three. Call her gestational mother. You give birth to a girl, a clone of the DNA donor. There are actually four, although I only gave you three women, but if you think about it, there are four different women who are potentially the mother of that child. There is DNA contributor, woman number one. There is egg donor, woman number two. There is gestational mother, woman number three. But the fourth possibility is the mother of the DNA donor. Because if you go with the idea that the clone is the sibling of the DNA donor and not the child, then the mother is actually one generation higher up, right? Now, if any of them are Goyim, some are Jewish, some are Goyim, you're going to have a serious question whether the child is Jewish or not. Well, the truth of the matter is, two of the women have to be of the same religion. The mother of the DNA donor and the DNA donor.
Yeah, the egg donor
should be a problem. No, but I'll tell you, in other words, the mother of the DNA donor and the DNA donor will always be of the same religion, because... If the woman's mother is Jewish, they're Jewish. But you could have an egg donor that's a guy or a gestational that's a guy. Now, keep in mind that this parallel. Now, so the issue is the kid Jewish or not Jewish? Now, keep in mind that this, of course, parallels the very same discussion we had about surrogate mothers, etc. But it's a bit more complicated in the following. In the surrogate mother issue, You only had two choices. The egg donor, okay? Yeah. The egg donor was also the genetic contributor. So we had a question, is egg donor the mother or is surrogate the mother? Here with cloning, you're slicing it even thin because the egg person is not the genetic contributor because the DNA comes from one source and the egg comes from another source. So consequently, even if the egg donor would be considered the mother in surrogate motherhood, that wouldn't be a proof to cloning where you've separated the egg donation from the DNA donation. So again, is the kid Jewish, etc.? Or if I have a clone and I have natural kids, or I have regular kids, so to speak, if the clone is my sibling, he will not inherit my estate. It'll go to my children. If the clone is my child, he will inherit my estate, right? So these yichlus problems are very, very compelling, very, very difficult. And again, once again, our gedolim are going to have to work it out if and when these problems ever come. Now, just a few more halachic problems. Again, just and if you walk out confused and not knowing anything, that's okay, because once again, these don't have any definitive answers. These are she'elos that one has to grapple with. And that is, until now, we've been doing what I call plain vanilla cloning, where the DNA comes from one person. All of these questions are going to be magnified hundreds of times when we start combining DNA from multiple sources. Because if you have a shaila, who is the father, who is the mother, when the DNA comes from one source, when the DNA comes from five people or ten people, you know, or you have a female clone, where DNA comes from many females, some of whom are Jewish, some of whom are not Jewish, is the kid Jewish, right? Right? It's going to be a real, real problem. What gets even more complicated is when we start combining animal and human DNA. Now, there are some very good scientific reasons for doing this. Robin Cook, you know, he writes medical thriller novels, had a novel in which a drug company, and this is actually benign, this sounds like a real good idea, was trying to develop animal organs, you know, animals having organs that were suitable for human transplantation. That would avoid the problems of brain death and the shortage of human donors. Right, right, right. But of course, the historical problem with the use of animal organs is that the human body rejects them, etc. And so it doesn't take. So here, some drug company thought of the following. This was the novel, but I'm sure it's being worked on. And that is, let's, as it were, import a certain part of human DNA into the embryos of developing animal fetuses so that their heart will be a human-type heart, so to speak, only specifically targeted to the development of an organ that will be non-rejected by the human organism. So, sounds good, because after all, the moral scruples we have about taking beating hearts out of human beings, we don't have about animals, and even though, obviously, let me just emphasize that we don't cause unnecessary pain to animals, but to save a human life, one is allowed to sacrifice an animal, and that's absolutely the halachic position. We do not believe in the notion of animal rights per se, meaning we believe animals should not be tortured, should not be harmed, should be kept with kindness and compassion, but we don't believe that they're equivalents to human beings. But here's what happened in the novel. The guy calls up from the field, you know, they have all these chimpanzees, etc. You know, John, I think we're in trouble here, because what happened was he notices that the chimpanzees start building fires and building, you know, homes, etc., and they start engaging in aggressive behavior, which seems to be more human than animal-like, an interesting little comment, you know. And what happens was the animals were becoming more and more human-like in their behavior. And the difficult issue is, when does an animal have enough human DNA that it, in fact, becomes a human? Now, you might argue, based on what I said before, that I don't care if this animal has human DNA. If it was born from a chimpanzee, it might be a chimpanzee. You know, you might have to deal with that. But still, one is very, very worried about this, and that is, how human is human? What percentage of human DNA will make something a human? Now, what might be pursued in lieu of cloning a whole organism would be to clone specific organs. Remember, keep in mind that any, the key to understanding this, even on a non-technical basis, is any cell of any part of the body can activate, can be reactivated for any other part. So you could clone, instead of cloning a human, you could clone a heart from a skin cell. You could clone a liver from a fingernail cell, etc.
How viable is that? Because you have to, it's like cancer. We're all born with cancer cells.
Right.
They're just in a locked position.
That's correct.
So how do we unlock those things?
Well, the point is this. Obviously, the locking and unlocking is the critical process in cloning. But the point is, to the extent you could unlock the whole genotype.
Do we know how to do such a thing?
Well, that's what cloning did. I mean, the cloning technology effectively found ways of unlocking that which was locked. So if you simply narrow it down and you could target it in a more specific way, you'd be able to clone hearts and livers, which would be wonderful because that would avoid the ethical problems of cloning entire organisms. But then you get into even greater nightmares. What if you decide to clone the whole body minus a cerebrum? So you've created this human-looking thing, which is kind of an incubator and a refrigerator and a preserver of all the internal organs with blood circulation and everything else. Have you created a human being or not? Again, very, very difficult questions. And once again, it just reminds us perhaps that maybe there are certain things that human beings should recognize that we're not able to do. What time do you have? Okay, I have to run. But anyway, Mr. Shammai, we have a good Shabbos. And next week, again, I think at least for this time around, we kind of covered our medical ethics areas. And I think on Sunday, I'll probably be talking about love and marriage and getting back to more human things. After cloning, I think we all need to get back to for now, yeah, just 2 weeks behind schedule, but I mean, basically covered the main topics.
You got it.